I thought that to complement the experimental talk on Monday, it would be good to start off with sort of the theoretical history of this field, beginning around 2005 or so, which means I'll be talking a lot in the first part of the talk about other people's work. I thought it would be good to give a theoretical picture, starting off with how people originally understood this phase, which was basically in terms of single electron physics. It's not limited to single electron physics, but that is where it all started. And in particular, for this audience, I'll try to present it in a way that makes clear that it's very closely connected to the integer quantum Hall effect first and to graphene second. So if you know a bit about those, then I think this is pretty comprehensible. Maybe two questions to keep in the back of your mind for the first part are, in the integer quantum Hall effect, states are classified by integers. Here, they're classified by so-called Z2 invariants, either oddness or evenness. So why is that true? Why Z2 instead of integers? And then a second difference between this and integer quantum Hall, as was said on Monday, there isn't really any genuinely 3D quantum Hall phase. They're sort of layered versions of the 2D phase. But here, there does seem to be a genuinely 3D phase that doesn't have any natural 2D interpretation. So why is there that difference? I'll try to explain that. Then the second part of the talk is sort of a new picture for the three-dimensional phase that's actually connected to some work by Wilczek and others back in the 80s, which is to define the phase in terms of a certain magnetoelectric response. And that actually teaches a little bit about other solids as well, not just topological insulators. And then finally, for many of us in this room, single electrons have a limited level of excitement, so it'd be nice to understand what new correlated phases or correlation physics could we get out of what we now know about topological insulators. Okay, so our goal is going to be to try to make something that carries a spin current, at least this is how it all started, driven by spin orbit couplings in solids. So the basic property we're going to need about spin orbit is that it breaks the SU2 spin symmetry, but preserves time reversal. So we can imagine, as kind of a caricature, the following state. The spin orbit coupling generates an effective magnetic field. And what I'm basically going to do is start with something unrealistic and make it gradually more realistic. Spin orbit generates a sort of pseudo-magnetic field that points up for spin up and points down for spin down. And I'll write out a Hamiltonian that does this in a moment, but what you can imagine happening if I tune it right is that maybe this pseudo-magnetic field, this is compatible with time reversal because time reversal flips the spin and flips the magnetic field. I could hope to get an integer quantum Hall effect state, nu equal to plus 1 for up and nu equal to minus 1 for down. So I'll write down a Hamiltonian in a second, due to paper number 2 over there, that actually makes this happen. So what we'd expect if we could get into this state would be that I've got my sort of integer quantum Hall droplet, except now we'll call it spin quantum Hall or quantum spin Hall or whatever. It turns out not to be a very good name. And I'll have up electrons that go one way around the edge, while down electrons go the other way along the edge. And then the current equation that this state will have, now there's no charge current if I apply an electric field to this state, but what we expect is that applying an electric field will give me a spin up current going one way, a spin down current going the other way. The charge currents cancel out, but I'm left with a non-zero spin current. So a current with two indices is how I describe spin. One is spatial. One is the spin direction. So I might hope to get something like epsilon k. So equations like this and this idea actually went back before 2005, but probably most people didn't think it was all that realistic. The main reasons for thinking it wasn't very realistic is that, first of all, to have some kind of perfectly dissipationless equation for a spin current doesn't take account of a lot of real processes in solids. But a bigger problem is that real spin orbit coupling doesn't separate up electrons and down electrons like this. That is, this model's unnatural because it has an additional conservation law. Sz is conserved, basically, so up and down don't mix. Once up and down mix, one would think that there's nothing that protects this edge. So for example, the integer quantum Hall effect edge is protected because I've only got electrons moving one way. Here I've got electrons moving both ways. You'd think that turning on full spin orbit coupling and disorder, say, will mix them and localize. I'll lose the state and it will just localize to an ordinary insulator. That turns out not to be right. So I think the theory paper that got many people much more interested in this field was this Kane and Millay paper, who basically constructed a model based on an older model to try and show why this is actually stable more generally. So let me introduce the Kane and Millay model. So they thought this might be relevant to real graphene. It turns out not to be very relevant to real graphene, for reasons I can discuss if you want, but it did lead people in the right direction for why the phase is stable. So I want electrons moving on a honeycomb lattice. If I started off with a spin-independent Hamiltonian, let me just start with the famous tight binding model of graphene. So as you probably all know, if I just have this term, hop an electron with whatever spin, nearest neighbor, I'll get a semi-metal. I'll get Dirac cones, and at half filling, I have Dirac points, that is the Fermi surface. If I wanted to open a gap in that, one way to do it that doesn't happen in real graphene, but does happen, for example, in boron nitride, where these two atoms are different, I could add a term that's still spin independent, but that's basically just sublattice staggering. So this is equal to basically plus one on A sublattice, minus one on B. This gives me what I'll call an ordinary insulator. It doesn't have edge states. It has a gap. The size of the gap is just related to this, so that's not very interesting. Now, what I want to do is think about a different way to open up a gap starting from this state, and that is going to be actually just this integer quantum Hall problem. So what Kane and Millay did was take this earlier model, which is for, so paper one is a model for a churn insulator, which means an integer quantum Hall state in a lattice system. It turns out to have no average magnetic field. It has sort of an anti-ferromagnetic field that breaks time reversal. And in terms of electrons with spin, let me write it as second neighbor hopping. And then the interesting part is a Vij, where this is equal to plus or minus one, depending on, let's see, 2 over root 3 d1 cross d2z, where d1 and d2, for example, if this is I and this is j, D1 and D2 are the two legs I go on to get there. So it obviously changes sign when J goes to I, so this is in fact Hermitian. Now, this term is allowed by all the symmetries of the lattice, and it does put me in this doubled integer quantum Hall state, but it's not very physical because, again, of the spin orbit coupling conserving SC. So just to kind of explain intuitively what this term does, I'm not going to work out the details. This I means it acts a bit like a magnetic field once I fix SZ, but it's a magnetic field that points one way for up and the other way for down, so this is just an explicit realization of this idea. But what they showed, and they refined their theoretical argument, and I'm going to give a sort of more modern version of it, is that if I add more realistic spin orbit coupling, so, for example, Rochba, So Rajpa is not a property of the graphene sheet itself, but for example, if I put it on a substrate, it's one of the dominant forms. I won't write it out, but the main thing you need to know about it is that it involves all three components of spin, so it no longer conserves SZ. Then the effect of that is as follows. Before, I could have had an integer number of different states in principle. Let me write it this way. I'm going to explain this statement in a second. Basically, once I put on realistic spin orbit coupling, I lose some aspects of the integer quantum Hall physics. I no longer have a full integer set of states, but I still have two possible states. Z2 just means the set of odd and even, or the group of odd and even. Here, we're going to call the two cases ordinary insulator and 2D topological insulator. So I want to try and explain why this is true. So that's saying that if I look at all two-dimensional band insulators, once I think about spin-orbit coupling, and in particular, once I think about time reversal, there's not just one band insulator phase, there are actually two, and the difference is that the second one is going to have edge states. Basically, the ordinary one, if I wanted to try and put it back in terms of the original Chern numbers, ordinary insulators, all even, IQHE states. And again, these are all doubled. So for example, that would be 0 up, 0 down, 2 up, 2 down, and so on, while this 2D topological insulator is all the odd ones. So why should there be this odd-even effect? Let me give some intuition based on the edge and then give the more rigorous mathematical reason.
Actually, so you promised that we asked, so I'm going to
ask. Sure, please.
So originally, in Malay, originally they said lambda s was sort of reasonably big.
Yeah.
And I know it turned out not to be so, but can you say
something
about why that happened?
Yeah, so what happened was, the story is that if I open up a gap with this, say, if lambda s is larger in energy scale than the Rajpa term, then that gap is stable, but the nature of the phase sort of changes. But if this is smaller than the Rajpa scale, which is actually the case in real graphene apparently, so their hope was that this would be Kelvin. There were three theory papers at about the same time by different groups saying it's more like millikelvin. Unfortunately, this intrinsic one, essentially second neighbor, and the fact that carbon is very light, while the Rajpa scale is well over a Kelvin.
But the Rajpa scale comes from like some perpendicular electric field or some such thing.
That's right. So in principle, if you suspended it and went down sub millikelvin, you might actually see this phase. But that's not an easy experiment. The problem, basically, the reason why all of these experimental papers are on heavy semiconductors is that spin orbit coupling is a relativistic effect that goes as the fourth power of Z. So you want to look down at the bottom of the periodic table. Graphene does have a great band structure, but it's just too light. So why should odd or even be special? And the two properties, where Z2 comes from,
the semiconductor is more related to the gap, right?
There has to be a gap. A way to state it that I know some people don't like, but makes sense to me, is that the spin or the gap that's in the actual material should be comparable on some level to the atomic spin orbit energy scale. So essentially, if you want to think about it, like in this picture, you would like the gap to be generated by spin-involving terms, is how I'd put it. Like, these terms that don't involve spin will never get you into the right phase. So the two elements that give the Z2 are Fermi statistics, or let's call it spin half, and T invariance. So a fact that you might teach in quantum mechanics is that every time reversal invariant system of spin half particles, all the eigenstates are twofold degenerate, so-called Cramer's degeneracies. And what that means in practice is that if I start with one of these paired eigenstates, that is one state and its time reversal conjugate or Cramer's conjugate, and I add some time reversal invariant perturbation, then I'm not going to be able to mix them because that would split the Cramer's degeneracy, and we know that doesn't happen. If you want to know why spin half, this is only true for spin half and not spin one, basically what Cramer showed is that two actions of the time reversal operator, this is equal to minus one to the two times the spin. So minus one for spin half particles, one for integer spin particles, because two actions of the time reversal operator are basically like rotation by 2 pi. Okay, so how does this help us understand this Z2 effect? Well, let me draw a picture of the edge in the simplest case where I've got one right mover and one left mover, like in that picture I drew on the circle over there. So if this is the edge Fermi level, let's say I've got an up spin moving right and a down spin moving left. So this doesn't tell me how I would get in the phase, but if I'm in the phase, it tells me why it might be stable. So at low energy, let's say I run a little bit of a spin current here. So I have one extra electron here, and I ask, what about that backscattering process? Well, if I've only got one Cramer's pair of edge modes, then the lowest energy right mover is the Cramer's conjugate of the lowest energy left mover, which means that this is actually forbidden by the statement I just told you. That is, non-magnetic scattering can't mix the two members of a Cramer's pair. Now, one immediate difference you see between this and integer quantum Hall, there's just nothing at low energy to backscatter to. Here, there is something to backscatter to. It's just that the lowest energy process is forbidden by symmetry. But if I allowed inelastic scattering, for example, if I went high up here, then that would be okay, because that would no longer be the Cramer's conjugate of this. And as a result, all the protection in this quantum spin Hall state is only power law rather than exponential. So it is somehow protected and quantized and dissipationless, although it's actually charge transport, not spin transport, that's quantized, but not as good as the quantum Hall effect. And then finally, where the Z2 comes from, suppose I now had two branches instead of one, then nothing forbids me from scattering from a right-moving branch to the left-moving branch that is not its time reversal conjugate. So effectively, the only rule that I have is that I can't scatter within a Cramer's pair, and that doesn't protect me if I've got two right-movers and two left-movers. If I had three or four or something, the belief is that I would localize in pairs until I got down to either one remaining or zero remaining. So in the generic case, we expect ordinary insulator has no edge mode, and this has an edge mode with one right mover and one left mover. Okay, so that's sort of the intuition for why there might be an even odd effect, but how can we relate this to the bulk? So is this really a topological phase, at least in the Thouless sense? So to do that, let me start off with what happens in the integer quantum Hall effect. If we do the integer quantum Hall effect, and to start with, let's think about a lattice. So I'll get rid of the lattice later, but for now, let's just think about a band structure. If I'm on a lattice, I can relate sigma xy and the number of edge modes to the Berry phases of magnetic block states. In fact, this might have been the first really neat application of Berry phases in condensed matter. So I'm going to assume a commensurate magnetic field so I can still define block states. So what this means, a Berry phase appears whenever I've got quantum mechanical wave functions that evolve smoothly with the parameter. In this case, the Berry connection, so this is a vector potential that lives in k-space. Later on, I'll start writing these with scripts to distinguish them from electromagnetic terms, but for now, until I get to part two of the talk, these are not electromagnetic, these are Berry. Write it this way. Where the UK is the periodic part of the block wave function. So this is a vector potential, and the reason for labeling it a vector potential is that it's just like a vector potential in E&M. It's gauge invariant in the sense that I know that the physics shouldn't change if I multiply my wave functions by an overall phase. So if I take uk to e to the I theta uk. But that will change A. So we can make gauge independent quantities out of A. It turns out that A itself has a lot of physical importance. In fact, pretty much anything reasonable you can make out of A seems to have some physical interpretation. This is something that should appear in the next edition of Ashcroft and Merman, if that ever comes out. So the Berry flux call that F. In 2D, that's just a number. So that Berry flux tells me the integer quantum Hall effect. So if I write it directly in terms of the UK, I can say that there's an integer, originally called a TKNN integer, now called a Chern number, associated with every band. The expression for it in terms of the U's is this. Minus the same thing with the order reversed. So that's pure imaginary. That makes it real. And if I sum up these integers over all occupied states, multiply by e squared over h, I get sigma xy. So this is, as was said on Monday, this is an example of a topological invariant, an integer, that comes from an integral of a local geometric quantity. In that sense, it's a little bit like integral of curvature gives you Euler characteristic in Gauss-Bonnet.
When you said that A is physical, you mean that things that you construct from A that are gauge invariant are physical, right?
Yes, but in fact, the gauge dependence of A does have a physical meaning. So the example I'll give will be polarization as an integral of A. And you can say that's gauge invariant, that's gauge dependent. It turns out that that gauge dependence is saying something physical about polarization. Basically, I'll come to it later, but I would say that even the gauge dependence of A has a physical meaning. Ask me again if you don't understand what I mean later on. But yeah, I mean, anything that's measurable has to be independent of gauge. That's certainly true. But I would say, for example, that polarization of a bulk crystal can't be uniquely defined in the same way that integrals of A are not uniquely defined, but it is defined up to some quantum. Okay, so integral of F, which is basically just what this is, integral of F over 2 pi, gives me the Chern number. And if you want to understand a little bit mathematically about what non-zero Chern number means, just because we'll be using something like this later on, so non-zero Ni means that there's no smooth wave function for the band over the whole BZ. So in that sense, this might be a tiny bit misleading. We could say that dA is equal to F locally. That is, given F, I can always find some local wave functions that will generate an A that will satisfy this in form notation, but I can't do it globally unless the integral of F is equal to zero. So if you like, these Chern numbers or TKNN integers measure the extent to which F is closed but not exact. If this were true globally, that's what we mean by saying that F is an exact form. So in that sense, Chern numbers are elements of what are called cohomology, which which is the difference between closed forms and exact forms. There's a totally different way to do this that turns out to be useful for some things, a different kind of topology called homotopy that I won't discuss because this seems to be more familiar to more people. But basically, the fact that I can do this always locally is called the Poincaré lemma. The fact that I can't do it globally will come back to exactly the same thing in two higher dimensions when we try to give a response function definition of the face. So that's just for looking ahead. Okay, so now what about the Z2 invariant? So the great thing about this formula, it tells me that if you just give me the bulk band structure of a two-dimensional system, I can deduce from that exactly what's going to happen at the boundary, how many edge modes there'll be. Or to be precise, I can deduce the residual chirality of edge modes. So whatever's going on at the edge is entirely determined by what's going on at the bulk, in the bulk. So what about the Z2 case? I want to write up a formula from Fu and Kane that we sort of had a geometric equivalent of. So we'll use their formula and our picture. So this is the Fu-Kane formula. And this is maybe the more mathematical idea of where Z2 comes from and not Z. So let me define a quantity that's going to be two parts. So let me explain first what this would mean. Now, this formula, the way I wrote it, is for non-degenerate bands, which is the natural situation if I've broken time reversal. If I haven't broken time reversal, well, there are two things that happen. First of all, every one of these is zero. You can show that explicitly if you want, or you can reason that sigma xy requires breaking time reversal. So with time reversal invariance, all of these old-fashioned topological invariants disappear. But there might be new invariants. And to make those, I should remember the fact that because of this Cramer's thing, all my bands will come in pairs. So that is, in any time reversal invariant fermion system, I have band pairs. This F is the total Berry flux for the two pairs. And then both of these integrals are over something I'll call the, well, this one is called basically half of the Brillouin zone, or effective Brillouin zone. And this is the boundary of half the Brillouin zone. And then finally, this is all mod 2. So this formula is pretty forbidding. Let me explain a geometric picture for what it's telling us. OK, so the reason why half the Brillouin zone is the natural object in a T-invariant system, if I know what's going on in the Brillouin zone, for example, the Bloch Hamiltonian at K, then that tells me what's going on at minus K. They don't have to be the same in general unless K is equal to minus K, but they're related by time reversal invariance. So what that means is, if I took my two-dimensional Brillouin zone torus, let me just cut it in half. Cutting it through here is special because it takes one k point from every k minus k pair. And there are four points that are special. These are the TRIMs that were talked about in Monday's talk. Let me just label them gamma A, B, C. And if I focus just on the right side, then it's reasonable to try and define a topological invariant just using information on the right side, because that's basically complete. And there's one subtlety, which is that in taking half of the Brillouin zone, I should really take half of the boundary as well, in that what's going on in this top line is related to what's going on down there by time reversal. But I don't want to get too much into details, because what I want to get to is 3D before too long. Anyway, so if I took half the Brillouin zone, then a nice way to represent this is as a cylinder, where now I've taken just the right half and rolled it up, keeping in mind that this is periodic with that. And now I see where I might run into a problem. which is that if I just integrate F, if I integrate F over a nice closed manifold with no boundaries, I'm pretty much guaranteed to get something useful. This is unfortunately an open manifold. It has these two boundaries. So the way to think about this term, and in particular why it has the relative sign it does, is that this is actually an integral of F over something I added to close this, basically to make it into a sphere. And because these are disk-like, I can apply Stokes' theorem and relate integral of A around this boundary to integral of F here. Now, you can ask, well, how do I know that I can always find some way to smoothly contract this to a point? How do I know that then if I do that, it's essentially unique? Well, first of all, this is always shrinkable to a point. And if you want details, that's in that paper. And then the non-trivial fact is this is obviously a gauge-dependent expression because it involves A, but the bit of heavy lifting, which is related essentially to the following fact about the boundary. I said this was sort of time reversal conjugate to that. That means that there's a relationship between what's going on one side of this cap and what's going on the other. Essentially, different gauges that are compatible with time reversal will have different values for this closure part, but those values will differ by an even integer. So the parity is well defined. And this, if you like, in bulk terms, which is maybe a little bit less intuitive than the edge picture, is why Z2 and not Z. So that, I would not say, is totally intuitive. When I come to sort of a new picture, newish picture of the 3D topological insulator, I think that might actually be a better way to think about Z2, but this is the original one. And again, largely due to Kane and Millet. So let me now explain why 3D. So this was essentially the answer to the question of why is it Z2 rather than Z in a time reversal invariant Fermi system? One question you might ask, just to get to it quickly, this was all in terms of Brillouin zones and band structure and so on. How is this robust to disorder? I'll come to interactions in a second, but for the disorder part, there are different answers. I hope Andreas will talk a little bit about it. One answer, in terms of the integer quantum Hall effect, if you're old enough, you probably remember something called floating of extended states in the integer quantum Hall effect, which was the idea that the integer quantum Hall effect is very robust to disorder, because in a disordered system, I can convert these K integrals to essentially now thinking about a finite system, but with phase twists at the boundary. And what that lets me do is, now in a finite system that's large enough, instead of ascribing integer quantum Hall effect integers or churn integers to each band, I can assign them to each state in a disordered system. And localized states will have churn number 0. The only way that I lose the integer quantum Hall effect is when a magical state that has non-zero churn number gets so affected by disorder that it floats through the gap. So effectively, what this says is that having a true gap is not really necessary for the integer quantum Hall effect. You need a mobility gap. You need a gap for extended states, because it's the extended states that are sensitive to boundary conditions. At the single electron level, we can do exactly the same thing here. That is, we can reformulate these in terms of boundary conditions. We can assign a churn parity to every state. And again, until I start to move extended states through the gap, I don't change the phase. And if you want some details, ask me after.
Joel, this D is either 1 or 0, right?
Yeah.
So if it's 1, you have this logical set, right? If 0, it's 0.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, didn't say that. And so far, it's fairly easy. If people are interested, there are some interesting differences in the phase diagram with this order between this and the integer quantum Hall effect that many people worked on, and we were some of the later people to work on it. But I don't think I'll cover that unless there's interest.
So this slightly non-discrete, these two gaps on the side, you're saying that no matter what the issue choose, you always get something which will not have to change as a module 2.
Right.
You're saying this.
So why? I can try and give a bit. So the most intuitive picture I have is this edge picture. The second most intuitive is the one I'll come to. But for this, the reason why, so remember what I said about this being conjugate to that. What that means is that here, I can draw it this way. In the bulk, time reversal invariance doesn't restrict me at all. On the boundary, there's basically a restriction between the right half of this and the left half of this from time reversal. And that's also true here. So to be very precise about this formula, there's a restriction on how A is defined. A is defined in such a way that this time reversal constraint actually applies everywhere. That is, always the left side of this is time reversal conjugate to the right side of this. And I can prove that such a thing exists. If you want to understand why that's sort of true intuitively, let me give a different reason, a different way to think about this cap, other than as a cap. If you want, this is a series of circles, and it tells me a continuous way to deform the boundary of this until it reaches a constant. And if I want every step to be a legal boundary, then every step has to have this time reversal conjugacy condition. So once I've got this relationship between, effectively the way I've drawn it, the half coming out of the board and the half in the board, what that means is that you can ask, well, suppose I've got two different ways to contract this. How can I prove that the difference between those ways will be even? Well, if I've got two different ways to contract the left boundary, let's call one F and one G. I can stick them together. And this is sort of G inverse because I pulled it through. So I can stick these together and make a sphere and ask, what is the Chern number of that sphere? Basically, the Chern number of this combined sphere is the difference that I'll get in these from using this gauge versus that gauge. Now, the relationship between the half coming out of the board and the half going into the board is enough to show that the Chern number of this sphere is even, basically because it's very tightly constrained by the fact that one half of it is equivalent to the other half. Basically, that tells me I can break it into two equivalent spheres with the same Chern number. So the evenness, which is the magic step, comes from the time reversal constraint at the boundary and being able to find a gauge or a series of boundary changes that have this relationship between one side and the other. So there's a different way, which, believe it or not, is actually even more complicated in terms of patches and so on, but this is sort of the geometric picture.
The cap itself is always even contributions, but there's nothing.
The difference between two caps is always even, but the cap itself is not always even, yeah. In fact, the cap itself is in general not integer, because this doesn't have to be integer, because it's not a closed manifold. While this combined object has to be an integer, because this is basically the Chern number of this whole closed thing, and then the tricky question is whether it's uniquely defined, and it turns out it isn't, but only the parity is defined. So in response to your question about how an integral over A could be physical, as you said, there are some ambiguities in anything with A, but there can also be some non-ambiguities, and this is an example.
So, Joel, not all the integers there have to be zero, right? The NIs individually can be non-zero.
It depends on how you define an NI. I mean, this expression, if I've got a single band, then the relationship between... So, okay, you're talking if I had, say, spin up and spin down degenerate bands, and I can choose a particular gauge for a degenerate band and define n's in that way. But the way I've written it, it's the single band formula, and for a single band, this has to be zero. So what you're saying is there's a particular choice of this formula for the two-band case, where if I took it as the sum of the one bands, they would be non-zero.
Right.
But if I took the, I think the more natural thing to do there is to take F2, the total F for the two bands is still gonna be zero, right? But yeah, it's a good question. What would happen if I had the sort of two copies of the integer quantum Hall effect, one for up and one for down, if I treated them as two independent bands that happened to be degenerate, I'd get n for up minus n for down. If I treated it as a two-band pair, then the total would be zero. Okay, so I think that's enough about 2D for now.
V2 was n mod 2 for that particular case. Right?
Yeah, that's right. So now, about a year after the Kane and Melli paper, in the summer of 2006, there were three papers within a couple of weeks of each other, here they are in alphabetical order, that all reached similar conclusions in different ways about the existence of a 3D state. So what's the difference between Z2 and Z invariants that lets you get a 3D state? So I'll give one picture. So now my Brillouin zone is a torus. And I'm going to focus mostly on the so-called strong topological insulator. Now, in this three-dimensional torus Brillouin zone of a time reversal invariant system, let me focus on xy planes. So let's call this k is equal to 0, k is equal to minus pi over a, k is equal to pi over a, and of course these are actually the same thing. So of these planes, there are some that are special. In fact, this plane and this plane are special because they're taken to themselves under time reversal invariance. That is, if I take any point on this plane, it gets taken to another point on that plane, while if I took some other plane in between, pi over 3a, for example, time reversal takes that down to here. So where this is going is that if I think about these planes as two-dimensional band structures, I can define 1z2 invariant for k is equal to 0. Call that z0 equal to plus or minus 1. I can define 1z2 invariant for kz equal to plus or minus pi over a. Call that z plus or minus equal to plus or minus 1. And the difference between this and the quantum Hall effect case is that these don't have to be the same. So let me explain that. If I make a three-dimensional lattice model in a magnetic field or something and compute the integer quantum Hall effect, this plane will have some 2D churn number treated as a 2D system. And as I move it vertically, that churn number doesn't change because it's always a two-dimensional system, and that's all I need for churn number to be defined. Here, as I move from here up to there, it's always a 2D system, but it goes from being time reversal invariant to breaking time reversal to being time reversal invariant again. So what lets us build a 3D state is that for these Z2 invariants, once I break time reversal, nothing protects the difference between odd and even. I can go from odd to even. I have to mix up and down spin, but I can go from odd to even without closing the gap if I'm allowed to break T. So if I have a series of two-dimensional Hamiltonians that lets me go from topological to ordinary by breaking time reversal, that tells me how to make a three-dimensional topological insulator. So that's saying that z0, z plus or minus 1, if this product is equal to minus 1, that's the so-called strong topological insulator. Now you might ask, well, what's so special about z? Well, it turns out that if this is true in the z direction, in fact, it's true in the other directions as well. So that's why there are four invariants. It turns out that three of them come from basically layering. So for example, if I wanted a complete set, and this is notation induced by Fouquet and Millet, I could take, say, z0, z plus or minus 1, and then say x0, y0, z0. And the way to think about this, this tells me whether I've got this truly 3D invariant, and then I still have three z2 invariants, which are basically whether I've layered two-dimensional systems. But those layered two-dimensional systems are very much like the 2D case. There's some interesting work by my colleague Ashwin Vishwanath on a defect in that weak topological insulator, but let me just leave aside all the weak invariants and focus on the physical consequences of this one. So this is a very abstract construction that doesn't tell you much about what is the physics you'd observe. I think actually the way I'm going to make that connection is through this magnetoelectric response bit, but let me just tell you what Fouquet and Millet worked out as far as how you could actually observe this. So if there's a bulk topological invariant, there should be a surface state. And pretty much all the experimental observations and all the neat physics you can do with that result from that surface state. So what is it?
Joel, can you go back? I'm sorry. I got lost on all of these. So what makes it then weak in this invariant? Like one of the invariants happens to be zero?
So weak, an example of a weak topological insulator would be if I just took decoupled 2D layers, then there'd be no KZ dependence. So let's say that this is topological and that's topological too. That would be a weak topological, and why do we call it weak? So the reason why we call it weak, and again, this is Buchanan Lay, if I think about layering the integer quantum Hall effect, if I have a bunch of copies of the same integer state, I have a non-trivial surface, the so-called chiral metal, which basically becomes, I've got higher and higher integers that add up to give me the number of edge states. The problem with Z2 is that if I add two odds, I get back to even. So for example, even if I just took two layers, now that's no longer very stable to disorder. So in principle, these are a way to think about it is the weak invariants are topological invariants of a band structure, but they don't really generalize to a disordered system, while the strong invariant does generalize to a disordered system. So that's why weak and strong.
So the strong is the one that have one odd, an odd number of bands crossing the gap. Well, not
at the surface, yeah. So let me.
And then the weak one would still have an even number?
Well, the weak would have an odd, but along a particular direction. Yeah, that's right. And it would also, I mean, the way to think about the weak is just as layers. So for example, that would mean that the boundary, again, there's no KZ dispersion. I've now got a sort of KZ independent mode going one way. But I can scatter between different values of KZ.
So the only example of a weak one is a stack of quantum Hall states?
Or a stack of, you mean, spin quantum Hall states. Yes. I mean, okay, that's not quite right, because you can have weak as well as strong. So that is, you can have a weak topological insulator that doesn't have the strong part, or you can have a weak topological insulator that does have the strong part. But if what you mean is a just weak topological insulator, where this is actually plus one, then I think that pretty much everything about that can be visualized in terms of the stacking. So for example, one non-trivial thing, but okay, some things, it's a bit counterintuitive. So a certain dislocation, or actually any dislocation in the weak topological insulator turns out to have a sort of mode moving along it. This is a paper in Nature Physics recently by Ying Ran and Ashwin Vishwanath, and I think Zhang maybe. And the way to picture that is just if I had it as a stack, then the way to view this defect is that one of these planes is ending, then that clearly has an edge mode. But it turns out to be true more generally. So I guess, as far as I know, everything can be visualized in terms of the stacking picture for the weak case and not for the strong case.
So these edge modes in the dislocations, that doesn't apply to the strong?
What was that?
The
distinguishing feature of the topological insulator, the strong topological insulator, is going to be surface modes. I'll come to that in a second. That's right. I would put that the mode that he's talking about doesn't really probe this. So it's there whether or not this is plus one or minus one, but it probes these.
But would it still be there if it's strong?
It would still be there if you had strong and weak. But if you had strong and no weak, then it would not be there.
But if you have the weak.
If you, it basically only, it's only sensitive to these weak invariants, yeah. But Leon, did you have a comment? Or?
I just wanted to say that you made it sound maybe like you have to be very anisotropic to be.
No, you don't. You don't.
You can be.
But it's. That's right. But it's
adiabatically
continuable. Exactly. It's adiabatically continuable to the stack. So, yeah, for visualizing it, the stack picture is nice, but that's certainly not what it has to really be like. Okay, so the picture of the surface. So the reason why this...
Joel, I have just a quick question. So in Ashwin's paper, if you have a strong insulator but the weak invariants are zero, then you can't have defects?
You can have defects, but this mode is not there on them.
This mode is not there.
Okay, so what the surface looks like, and this is too simple for bismuth antimony, but the reason why the bismuth selenide that's mostly the focus of this experiment in theory Nature Physics paper just came out on Monday, the reason why that's so exciting is that that behaves very much like the simplest possible surface of the topological insulator. So the way to picture it is that I've got a bulk gap. I've got a surface Fermi surface. It doesn't have to be at the Dirac point. So let's say it's some distance away from a Dirac point, and these eventually merge into the bulk valence and conduction bands. Let's say, in the simplest case, this is at gamma. And if I blow this up, there's one spin state at each k. So if you like, the way to think about the surface And I'm not going to try and derive it directly from the Boolean invariant, but I will explain a little bit about how they're connected in this new picture. It's 1/4 of graphene, because there's no valley degeneracy and no spin degeneracy. Yeah. So, for example, the reason why this is, well, if you want a surface picture of why this is very stable to disorder, it's like graphene would be with no intervalley scattering. So, as you mentioned yesterday, in graphene, that's an assumption because you need to assume a smooth potential, but here it's really robust. Okay, so, well, let's make a connection between this and a different picture. So now we're getting to part two. Let me remind you of one of the special things about graphene. So there's a Columbia group measurement on the quantum Hall effect in graphene. So if I measure sigma xy, I don't get any old integer times e squared over h, at least not in a single electron picture. I get things like minus 10, minus 6, minus 2, 2, 6, 10, dot, 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 times e squared over h. So if I were to divide this by a factor of 4, then I see that this is actually, well, integer spaced, but there's an offset of half an integer. So that's saying that if I manage to apply a magnetic field and gap the surface with an odd number of Dirac fermions, then I expect a half integer sigma xy. So this counting would mean the graphene has 4 Dirac fermions and the topological insulator surface has a half. So it turns out that from this, one can understand a bit about how to connect the 3D Z2 invariant to maybe the oldest kind of Z2 in condensed matter. So let me show what is the simplest way to get a Z2 in a time reversal invariant system.
Right. I mean, in the sense
that's a single electron, it's still a single electron picture, but that's right. In fact, we're going to be able to get this to be any arbitrary fraction. So there's no fractional charge. Basically, when I include the other surface, I'll get the other half. And in general, we'll see that this is going to be related to something called a theta angle. And if I have this at the top, then I have, yeah, some other possible integer minus theta over 2 pi at the bottom.
I'm just overall one half comes from the saying that counting this is a quarter of the contribution from the two states, for instance.
That's right. So jumping ahead a little bit, what's going to happen in the topological insulator is that there is actually a half integer sigma xy at the top surface and a half integer at the bottom surface. So added together, that's consistent with integer.
So that's only for a semi-infinite?
You'd only get half integer is only for a semi-infinite thing. In practice, like if I add these two together, I'll get an integer. So to give you an idea of sort of what I think is the simple picture to go with, imagine putting a flux in a solenoid through a ring, and I've got some kind of electrons or something moving around this ring. What I can imagine happening is, what are the time reversal invariant cases as far as if I look at just properties of the ring? So basically an Aronov-Bohm effect. So we know that because of gauge invariance, basically the physics of the ring, if the electrons don't get into the solenoid, only measures the flux modulo of flux quantum. So and let me just think about single electrons. So I can gauge away some integer times h over e. And that's why there are really two time reversal invariant cases of this problem. One is obviously to have zero flux. So if I have 0 or 2h over e, h over e, that's fine. Time reversal invariance will take, say, 0 to 0. But it's also true that the half flux quantum, or pi flux, and if you, I guess, followed the high TC literature, this is a familiar idea. A state with a pi flux is time reversal invariant in the following sense. If you looked inside the solenoid, you could certainly tell which way the flux is going, and you would break, and you'd be able to tell that it breaks time reversal. But if I can only measure the flux modulo 2 pi, then say if I've got a pi flux, time reversal takes that to minus pi, and minus pi is gauge equivalent to pi. So somehow there is a time reversal, there's a way to get a z2. So here the z2 is just 0 flux or pi flux. You can get a z2 out of the combination of periodicity and something that's odd under time reversal. And that is, we're going to be doing a slightly more complicated case, but that's the basic idea of where the 3D z2 comes from in terms of a magnetoelectric response. So the fact that there's a surface quantity here, what I want to explain is that this surface sigma xy, once I've gapped the surfaces, for example, by applying a magnetic field in this example, I'll say it's mostly a bulk property in the same way that surface charge in a crystal is mostly a bulk property, namely polarization. So before getting into that, let me sort of give the history. Before thinking about microscopic electrons in solids, the point of this magnetoelectric response picture is going to be, let's get away from band structure and things like that and think about what is the response of the system to some perturbation that tells me whether it's ordinary or topological. And it turns out that most of the relevant physics was worked at in a really ahead of its time paper by Wilczek, who said that there's a certain type of magnetoelectric term you might have in insulators, and that will lead to properties like surface quantum Hall effect and so on. So we're going to relate it to the solid in a moment, but before we do that, let's just think about what Wilczek called axion electrodynamics. Which means, it's very simple, just an additional term in the electrodynamic action inside a solid, which is theta e squared over 2 pi h e dot b. Because it's going to turn out that effectively topological insulators are theta equal to pi and ordinary insulators are theta equal to 0, and that is just a more fancy version of this kind of z2. Okay, so what would this term do? Well, the first thing that's special about it is that this is actually a total derivative, and now when I write f's and things like that, for the moment I mean electromagnetic f's. So the idea of this term is we know that in an insulator I can modify the permeability, I can modify the dielectric constant. Even though this term may be 0 in vacuum, there's no reason why I can't generate it. So it obviously breaks time reversal because it's got a linear and B term, breaks inversion, and it's a total derivative. If you like, I think it's theta over, if I remember the index counting, basically two electromagnetic Fs. So this is what's called the second churn form of the electromagnetic field string. So now I'm going to assume that people know a bit about quantum Hall to make the connection to what's going on at the surface. So now, if it's a total derivative, we don't expect constant theta to do anything. If I have a change in theta across a boundary, say, well, what I can do is take this term and integrate by parts, so I get a derivative on theta, and then I'll get a term AI FJK at a boundary. And this term is the electromagnetic Chern-Simons term, and if you're familiar with quantum Hall, this is exactly the electromagnetic term that I get if I integrate out the fermions in a quantum Hall state. So this is all arguing that at a surface where theta changes, I get a layer with a quantum Hall conduction, or a Hall conduction that is the change in theta divided by 2 pi. Now, what I want to use, this isn't going to be an argument that theta is periodic. If you give me the bulk and you tell me that the boundary is gapped, but don't tell me anything else about the boundary, at the boundary, I can always add an integer quantum Hall layer without modifying the bulk. At the moment, both bulk and boundary are gapped for this to exist. So I've assumed some magnetic field or other perturbation to open up the gap. Yeah. So a boundary can keep same bulk. Where integer means integer times e squared over h, but I can't locally add a fractional part, at least at the single electron level. So that's where I went from delta theta here. So to get to these formulas, I assumed that one side of the boundary was vacuum, and I added integers n and m, because the bulk doesn't tell me what those have to be. So that's the condensed matter version, basically, of why theta is periodic. It's in the same sense that at the boundary, of a an insulator. Just as I can add an integer quantum Hall layer in this picture, a more familiar idea is that I can add a surface charge if I'm talking about crystals, at least, of some number of charges per transverse unit cell. But I can't add a fractional part. Essentially, the surface charge of a crystalline insulator has a fractional part that comes from the bulk polarization plus possibly some integer surface charges. Here, sigma xy has some possible integer contributions that we can't rule out, but it has a fractional part that comes from theta. So what this says is that the magnetoelectric response that this generates, let me draw that, measures what theta is. So far we're just following Wilczek. We haven't said anything microscopically about what determines theta, because that wasn't done in the 80s. That's the new thing. But the effect is the following. So let me think about a slab and assume that I've got a theta over 2 pi squared over h up here, and a minus theta over 2 pi squared over time here, and apply an electric field. Well, then I'll get, say, a current running one way up here, current running the other way down there. Those circulating currents generate a magnetic field. So there's a magnetoelectric response, I guess in condensed matter terms, or alternately a polarization response to an applied orbital magnetic field that measure theta, basically, again, theta e squared over 2 pi h. So if you like, purely from this abstract viewpoint of assuming you had a theta, the way to think about e squared over h in 3D sort of a quantum of polar of magnetoelectric polarizability. And this is actually measured. Well, not the quantum, but just to show that this is not entirely crazy. Forgetting about topological insulators for the moment and just thinking about materials. So I haven't said anything about microscopics of this, but you could just go out and do an experiment to measure theta. And theta, the one experiment I know of, in CR2O3, it's about pi over 24, experimentally. So this is not the full magnetoelectric response. There are also E cross B terms and things like that, but they were able to isolate specifically the E dot B term. It is measurable, so it does seem to exist. Now, the last thing I want to say about this magnetoelectric polarizability, which is the new bit, and here, let me mention two papers. This paper by Chun News Group, which was on the archive in 07 but didn't come out till 09, and a paper by the Stanford Group from 08.
So when the prediction was before, this coefficient for whatever
the so this coefficient, if the surface can be gapped by, say, a weak magnetic field, so the idea is you want to gap the surface but not modify the bulk, it should be pi. And, or if you like, I mean, an easier way to... If it's not gapped, then it's metallic. So effectively, this picture is the natural picture if the surface has been gapped. The picture of a gapless 1/4 of graphene is probably the best picture if the surface hasn't been gapped. Basically, the reason why, the connection between the two, if I want to change this from 0 to pi, if this is going to be well-defined in between, then it has to take on values that would break time reversal, because only 0 and pi, again, by the argument of periodicity and this being odd, only 0 and pi are the time reversal compatible values. So I can either keep it gapped and break time reversal, or it can be gapless. That's in this picture why there's a gapless surface if I'm not allowed to break T. So the experiment that I know is underway at least one place and possibly several would be to take a chunk of a strong topological insulator, apply a magnetic field to try and gap the surface, and then probe, for example, with microwaves, whether this sigma xy is non-zero. And it should not just be non-zero, but quantized. That would basically be like trying to measure these half integers. The problem is you have to make sure you don't see the other surface, but there ought to be some sigma xy there.
Can you just put context on the top and measure
sigma? You can. The one problem is that you've got this surface that goes all the way around, so it's a little bit like there's no boundary of a boundary. This surface, there's always going to be a sort of parasitic loop around the other side of the sample. But in principle, there should be. That would be a good way to tell that it's metallic, for example. Before you put on the magnetic field. And I think there is an experiment like that underway at Princeton.
So you can't? You're saying...
I think it's actually...
You can't do it.
I'll put it this way. I suspect that it's impossible to do a four-terminal measurement under the normal conditions that will measure a half integer times e squared over h. If you want to know how I think it could be done, I think the Stanford people has the same, and actually there's another paper by Kane that was maybe the first to propose it. If you can do an optical measurement of sigma xy and make the assumption your sample is big enough that whatever your probe is, it doesn't manage to penetrate to the other side, I think that's probably the best way to measure one surface.
C is not possible.
That's right. I would love to be wrong, but I think measuring a half integer.
Joel, is the problem with measuring a quantized conductance or measuring conductivity?
I think it's deeper than that. I guess I don't think you can do either. I think that somehow a four-terminal measurement that's close enough to the ground state and doesn't have dissipation, I would think it's almost fundamental that it has to give you an integer times e squared over h. But that's mostly intuition. I couldn't prove it. But if there is a four-terminal measurement that gives rigorously a half integer in anything, that is, I mean, whether it's you're measuring rho or sigma, to me that would be extremely impressive. It would be a pleasant surprise.
So in the experimental case, when you're thinking about it, you're thinking that the top surface and bottom surface, they're connected. Half of the fermions are on the top, the other half. Now, what if I do this, that I cleave the crystal in a way so that the top surface and the bottom surface, there is no smooth surface to connect them. I mean, it's three-dimensional, but then...
That's right, but again, it's this topological property that even if it's rough somehow, so for example, if you made it very rough, you would just kind of move the surface inward. I think that it sort of has to be closed topologically. I mean, I can't say I've thought about it in great detail, but so effectively, what I think is special about the optical version is that you're effectively invoking some kind of dissipation in the bulk by impurities or whatever that's letting you keep one surface from talking to the other. So there, dissipation is actually good. I think if you're doing the traditional four-terminal looking for dissipationless effects, I think you can't get a dissipationless half integer E squared over H out of non-interacting electrons. But again, would love to be wrong. And the last thing I want to say in this direction is, how does this all connect to microscopics? And that's part of the point of paper 9. So something I said earlier was, there are a lot of interesting Berry phases of block electrons. So we know that integral of F gives me both the integer quantum Hall effect and the anomalous Hall effect in metals, or the intrinsic part. If you want to know more, ask Kara. Integral of A gives the polarization. So to explain that, this is work of Dowlis and then Vanderbilt. Integral of A is certainly a gauge-dependent quantity. But if I make a gauge change, it turns out that the polarization only changes by a quantum. There's a quantum of polarization, which in 3D is a surface charge. So the next object moving on that you might try to work out is, so the relation between these two is that dA is F. So there's a quantity that can be fractional and has a quantum in 1D. Basically, A is a one-dimensional quantity in some sense. And this is a quantized thing in 2D. So in the same way, there's an object, the 3D Chern-Simons form. Okay, so now I've switched. Before I was talking about electromagnetic A and F. Now, maybe I'll try writing twiddles. Now I'm back to Berry phases. I guess K doesn't need one. Wedge means using that epsilon symbol again. So this is the so-called first Chern form, and A, if you wanted, you could call it 1D Chern-Simons. This is the so-called 3D Chern-Simons form. And basically, this is going to be a quantity that's fractional in general, but has a quantum. And this is a naturally 4D quantity. It underlies what's sometimes called a 4D quantum Hall effect. That's not quite as robust as the 2D quantum Hall effect, but it does have some topological significance. So if you want to know what this K is, basically, if you gave me a band structure, then I can compute the following. So this is more or less what papers 6 and 8 are about, although 6 doesn't say it explicitly, but there's a way to use the result in 6, which is what we did. Theta is given by some constant times integral of trace over occupied bands of A by partial J this way K minus 2/3 AI AJ AK. And if you're wondering about why it's that quantity exactly, that's the quantity whose differential gives me the F wedge F. Okay. So what does this mean? Well, this is the Chern-Simons form now. Which, again, you might be used to from quantum Hall, but it's the Chern-Simons form of the Berry connection. So at least for the non-interacting case, it turns out this doesn't quite generalize to the interacting case, but for the non-interacting case, this theta, which is some electromagnetic property, has a microscopic expression in terms of something coming from the band structure, which in general is the non-abelian Chern-Simons form. Now, something you may know about the non-abelian Chern-Simons term from quantum Hall is that this is, in general, gauge-dependent by a quantum. So what that means is, again, this involves A, so we expect some kind of gauge dependence. If I make an SUN gauge transformation, then there are some so-called small gauge transformations that are smoothly contractible to the identity. Those don't change theta. But there are also what are called large gauge transformations, which result from the fact that the so-called third homotopy group, basically there are non-trivial maps from the three sphere or the three torus to this space of gauge transformations. Those are labeled by an integer, but what matters for us is that if I choose different gauges for this, then I get values of theta that differ by 2 pi, which is what we expect physically. So something that we did was first derive that formula from this paper of Shao et al. From 2007. What they were thinking about, what they showed was that the second Chern form appears, and Chern-Simons appears if you think about polarization in an inhomogeneous medium. And then the way to get this theta formula is just to think about a weak magnetic field as an inhomogeneity, and that gives you exactly this formula in a much simpler way than in that Chi et al. Paper.
Joe, in that formula, what does N stand for? N, what is N? Physically.
Sorry. N is the number of occupied bands.
Okay. That's always even.
In a time-reversal invariant system, it's always even, but this is not limited to time-reversal invariant systems. Okay. There is one subtlety. If you had an single occupied band, and this gets into something that is maybe relevant to what Andreas might talk about. With a single occupied band, you have abelian Chern-Simons, which is gauge invariant. Somehow, there are accidental topological facts that occur in systems with a finite number of bands. We even wrote a paper on this abelian Chern-Simons case that leads to something called the Hopf insulator, but those are somehow accidental. Once you turn on disorder, I think it's fair to say that no fact that is specific to a finite number of bands should appear in the disordered case. So one thing I probably should have said at the end of the discussion of the single electron picture, there are now two complete classifications that I think agree, one by Schneider et al. And one by Kitaev, on all the possible symmetry classes. So this is just, everything I'm saying is about one symmetry class, time-reversal invariant fermions, but there are something like 10 symmetry classes. So on Thursday, I think we'll hear more about that. Okay, getting back to this simple case. Let me give a many-body picture for why theta should be quantized and how you can measure it even when this formula is not valid. It does depend on being able to make a box. And maybe this is why the fact that there's something special about the diagonal magnetic polarizability should have been realized a long time ago by people working on polarization. And that's the following. I said that there's a natural polarization quantum, which is a charge per transverse area. There's a natural flux quantum in a box. That is, there's a minimum orbital flux I can apply and retain the symmetry periodic boundary conditions. That is H over E times a transverse area. So this here, for example, if I'm applying B that way to generate a P, which is one measurement of theta that I wrote over there, then that minimum P I can get, or the ambiguity in P, has exactly the same unit cell dependence as this orbital magnetic field quantum, and nothing about this is specific to non-interacting electrons. So essentially, polarization has a messy unit cell dependent quantum, but magnetoelectric polarizability has a quantum that does not involve a unit cell and is exactly E squared over H. So if you want to know what this quantum means, if you think about undergrad E&M, the Lorentz force law, E plus V cross B, gives you a natural way to convert electric to magnetic and back. This is basically down from that by a fine structure constant, so 1 over 137. So for example, if you have a bulk material and you want to know if it's a topological insulator or ordinary insulator, we did this numerically for some test models, all you have to do is apply an orbital field and measure how much the polarization changes. If it doesn't change, it's an ordinary insulator. If it does change, then it's a topological insulator. If it changes by half of this quantum, it has to do with its time reversal invariant.
So this was for per gap surface, or?
Well, this is actually bulk. So you can apply this formula. For example, this is a formula in terms of the bulk band structure that tells you what will happen if you have a gap surface. In general, if you get theta equal to pi, so I'll put it this way. The bulk formula tells you what theta is. If theta is equal to pi, then what happens at the surface depends on whether you've applied some perturbation to gap it or not. But if theta is equal to pi, you know it's either gapless with the number of direct fermions that's odd.
I got that. The question is, you do some electromagnetic experiment.
Oh, yes, then you have to gap the surface. Yeah.
You have to gap the surface. That was the question. So that's no easy experiment.
Well, it would already be nice to, for example, either putting contacts on, like, for example, in the optical experiment I like, you should be able to measure that the surface is metallic before you put on a magnetic field. And then you put on a magnetic field and you see that it's got this sigma XY quantized. That would be the signature. So essentially, it would look very much like graphene except for this factor of 1/4. Okay, so that, I think, is the end of part two. And maybe I'll just do 10 minutes on part three. So, and just to make a point, for example, I said that theta, so even though for subtle reasons, okay, with the quantum Hall churn form, this can naturally be gauged, and that is put in terms of boundary fluxes and applied to an interacting system. This, unfortunately, does not. I think that the Chern-Simons and second churn structure is basically specific to non-interacting electrons. But at least for non-interacting electrons, this is kind of a useful result, not just for topological insulators. This says that given any band insulator, for example, that CR2O3, the orbital part of it is determined by that formula. And that formula...
So should the statement is based on the fact that I can recast it as a phase twist versus the, I have to pay attention to the K-dependent wave function?
Yeah, so here's basically the problem. In going from the band structure to the many-body problem, I go from single electron wave functions to many-body, to a single many-body ground state. Unfortunately, and that's fine for F, but because this really depends on the non-abelian part, I sort of lose that information when I go to a single many-body wave function. So in other words, something about the twisting of the different single electron orbitals around each other is important for theta, but not important for either ordinary polarization or ordinary integer quantum Hall effect. And that information, if I just have access to the many-body wave function,
let's say I have no translation. So for instance, I don't want to talk about K. I still can talk about the twist of the real sample.
Then it's okay. If I have...
And then the A part would be can be cast in the current phase twist.
So what I mean to say is, with this, if I have single electrons with disorder, I think I can probably recast this. But if I have interacting electrons and I just want to use the many-body wave function, then I don't think I can. So for example, there are two ways to recast this formula in terms of boundary twists. If I'm studying disordered physics, I usually keep the single electron wave functions, but now I have them in terms of boundary fluxes. But what Niu and Thallis and Wu did is actually think about the many-body wave function. And then just in terms of the many-body wave function, you can define the quantum Hall response. That, I don't know how to do for theta, except by this direct measurement of the polarization. And there's sort of good arguments why it can't be done. But if you're interested in single particle disordered physics, this should be the list. Okay, so that's all. All of this is basically things that can be understood in terms of single electrons, even if they're robust interactions. The last couple of things I want to talk about are, starting with this paper number 10 by Fu and Kane, what are some new correlation effects we could get? So essentially, everything experimentally relevant, I think, about the 3D topological insulator comes out of the surface. But the excitement is, if you went back 5 or 10 years and you asked people whether, in the two-dimensional case, if you made a quantum well and went to, millikelvin temperatures, might you see some kind of interesting transport at the edges of a 2D system? I think everyone would believe that, and people would not have been jumping to get mercury telluride quantum wells and dilution refrigerators. The thing that's kind of exciting about the 3D, leaving aside theoretical stuff, is that these are just chunks of bulk 3D material, and they have large band gaps, which means you can study them at reasonable temperatures. So if you went back 5 or 10 years and told experimentalists that, you know, as of these experiments in 2008, there will be bulk 3D materials that you can study in your laboratory that have topologically generated surface states, and you don't need to go to millikelvin. In fact, you don't need to go that much below room temperature to start seeing signs. I think that would have been a surprise. So for theorists, we can ask, well, since we have access to this new source of interesting single particle physics, what can we do with many particle physics? Now, the first thing I know that was really interesting to me, at least, was a proposal by Foon Kang, which is to take this surface. Get some more chalk. If I take the 2D surface of the 3D strong topological insulator, and let me imagine it's like Bi2SE3 single rack. Then I've got a single spin state at each K. And now let me imagine the proximity effect if I put on top of this surface a normal superconductor that is S wave. So that just means at the single quasi-particle level, I want to add a term delta Ck up, C minus K down, plus summation conjugate. I assume the delta is real and constant. Now, the neat thing about this surface state is that this pairing acts entirely within the gapless set of states, or the set of states that were originally gapless. So for example, k up and minus k down is exactly that pairs the one state that's here and the one state that's here. So for example, down here and up here would be states that are quite a large distance from the Fermi level. So somehow the number of degrees of freedom that are involved in the pairing is basically one state at each k. So in that respect, this is not like an ordinary S-wave superconductor, at least as far as counting number of electrons. This is like a P plus IP, but with a couple of differences. It doesn't break time reversal. It does involve both spin components. So I'll say a slightly different reason, a different proposal for why this is interesting. But the reason why this attracted some interest is that there are a lot of nice things about, in particular, the weak pairing P plus IP state in two dimensions. So for example, for those of you who work on fractional quantum Hall, the Moore Reed state at nu equal to 5/2 is essentially a P plus IP state. And what that means is if I make this layer, probably the special thing about it is that this is, so I said this is different from P plus IP, but it's enough like a P plus IP. A vortex gives a Majorana zero mode. So I'm not going to try to derive that. If you want a nice paper, there's a nice paper from Reed and Green, maybe around 99, which shows that, first of all, almost all the physics of the 5/2 state can be understood in terms of just the P plus IP BCS-like superconductor. And Majorana Zermatt, I'll say what a Majorana fermion is and give a different proposal to make one. But if you're interested in topological superconductivity, let's say, and fractional quasi-particles like Majoranas, then this is a relatively easy way to make one, because all you need are S-wave superconductors, which we already have, and 3D topological insulators, which we already have. So to make it is probably easy, and to probe it is probably very hard. So let me now give a 2D way to make a Majorana. And this is discussed by Kataev and a different paper by Fu and Kim. So first, what is a Majorana? I throw this word around. Basically, it's a fermion that is its own antiparticle, or is half of a Dirac fermion. Dirac fermion is the ordinary kind of fermion that we deal with, like an electron. So what, if you want an example of how to make one, I can break C. I can make that into two Majoranas. Using the algebra, let's say gamma 1 is equal to C plus C dagger. Let me normalize it over 2, and gamma 2 is equal to C dagger minus C y over root 2. So these are both permission, which means that the creation and the annihilation operator of Majorana fermions are the same thing, effectively. They are their own antiparticle, as I said. So given any, this I want to say a tiny bit about the physics about here. I basically am just saying this in case if you're interested in topological phases, then by all means, read about that. This Majorana, let me give a quick intuitive explanation for why this should happen. Now first note that if you give me any Dirac fermion system, I can introduce Majorana notation, but that doesn't mean it's physical. We would like a physical situation where the low energy excitations of the system are separated Majorana fermions. And to do that, think about the quantum spin Hall edge. And imagine, to start with, I put a ferromagnetic on it that points one way, a ferromagnetic region on top of it that points one way, and a ferromagnetic region on top of it that points the other way.
So now we're considering a 2D quantum spin Hall state and a 1D edge.
That's right. That's right. So I have a 1D system which I can write in terms of a 1D gapless fermion. And let's say that, okay, technically I want these to point in plane directions. So let's say it's up along X, down along X. And let's say that up along Z is right, down along Z is left. So here, there's a calculation you can do. Basically, this breaks time reversal, so we expect it to open a gap. So there's no low energy state here. There's no low energy state here. These are both particle conserving, that is the term I get at the boundary from this effect of a local magnetic field will not let me get Majorana, so I'll get a so-called Jacquive-Rebbe soliton. I'll get a trapped ordinary fermion at the boundary between those. So, and that is essentially a property of the 1D Dirac equation that I won't go into. If I go ferromagnetic superconductor, ferromagnetic, well, the idea of this Kataev proposal and Fu-Pin proposal is just that, well, this has to go somewhere. There's sort of a symmetry between this spot and that spot. So what it actually does is break up into gamma 1 and gamma 2. And if you want to understand how this is actually measurable, so the reason I bring this up, even though I've mostly been talking about the 3D state, I think this is a lot easier to measure probably than the 3D state. And as far as how it's actually measurable, let me mention a couple of things. There's a PRL by the Dienocker group. I wish I could remember the rest of the others, but I can't. Which is actually, how could you look at the noise and the current of essentially electrons tunneling into some combination of this Majoranas? What they did is mostly take over a calculation by Bullich and Demler on the abstract problem of tunneling through this kind of Majorana fermion situation. They applied it with some numbers coming from the Fu and Kane proposal, And this gives a very specific experimental proposal for how you might observe the Majorana fermion. So for example, there are these people in Microsoft just across the way who are very excited about the Majorana fermion. If I had to bet on where the first Majorana fermion will be seen in condensed matter, I don't usually win my bets, but I'd probably be betting on this at the moment. So that's why to me it's interesting. And then finally, something that I've worked on a bit with a student.
This is about the Schaff noise argument, or?
Measuring it in noise is the best way, yeah.
So what exactly would we measure that would be different than conventional noise?
Oh, I don't know enough about the details. Carlos, do you want to, is he still around?
The shot noise doubles the twice as a factor of two compared with the current, the fan factor is twice as large as if it, the localized case would have been a Dirac fermion.
So it's something like prefactor in front of East, where this power spectrum at low frequency will look like twice.
And then the one thing I found interesting about this was there's a lot of work on random spin chains and other random 1D systems. If you just replicate this, you get a problem of many randomly coupled Majorana fermions, and it turns out that this realizes the, a kind of spin chain talked about, for example, by Bonesteel and Yang, Kung Yang, who's here. And I think this might, assuming you can do it with one or two, if it turns out to be easier just to throw down some phase-separated ferromagnet and superconductor, you naturally wind up at a 1D random quantum critical point. So these 1D random quantum critical points have been studied for maybe 15 years with hundreds of papers. As far as I know, there's no experiment on them. But I do think this might be a way to measure a non-trivial 1D strongly random quantum critical point. And the student working with me on that is named Vasudha Shivamogi.
Okay. So to come back to the noise, is it known how sensitive the signature and the noise is to interactions?
If the Majorana fermions were close enough to each other?
You know, going back to the first case, the Banacker theory, so if one was to include interactions, would that sort of wipe out the signature you see in the noise, or would it not? Is it obvious?
So which interaction are you thinking of?
I'm thinking about interactions in the 2D quantum spin Hall state.
It's all in terms of an effective Hamiltonian that is I gamma 1 gamma 2 with some hopping plus electrons hopping from the leads into gamma 1 and gamma 2. I don't think that any of that is modified by interactions in the 2D bulk. I mean, the parameters will be modified, but I think the structure of the Hamiltonian they use is the same. Is there a particular reason you're...
Yeah, the reason is that all these correlations is essentially current-current correlation. Hamiltonian threes and other ones are affected by the trivial, not the topological. You know, there are universal numbers for fermion boson from Majorana, but basically the prefactors are sensitive to interactions.
Yeah, the one reason, I think it might be possible to isolate those here because you can always get rid of the superconductor. That is, you can cross over from this to that, and hopefully whatever the bulk prefactors are, those are the same. Maybe that's too simplified, but I would like to, it seems like there could be some way to normalize out that effect. Anyway, I think it's worth trying. I'll put it this way, every other way I know to see a Majorana fermion has similar difficulties. So for example, if you wanted to see a Majorana fermion this way, you'd make a pinned vortex and look for the zero mode. Where the zero mode lives, you have kind of a vortex core. If you like, the zero mode lives in the superfluid outside the vortex core, but what you have to look for is some way to distinguish your Majorana zero mode from the Karoly Matricon-Degen modes in the vortex core, and that seems to me at least equally difficult. So that's why I feel that this Majorana proposal is as reasonable as anything else I've heard. I mean, I have not, obviously it's not my proposal, but to me it seemed promising.
What do you include when you say C?
I just mean a direct fermion, a single direct fermion. So I'm assuming this
to see the Majorana.
Oh, I see. Okay, so for example, you could imagine, okay, I guess there might be a propagating Majorana mode at the surface of a Mohr-Reed state or something like that. I guess what I mean is a single localized zero energy state that is clearly a Majorana. I mean, C doesn't mean that you have to like look at it with your eyes. I just mean a direct measurement of it rather than an indirect inference. I mean, all this is kind
what
of...
What do you consider indirect? I mean, is interferometry...
Yeah, I mean, everything we do in physics is somehow indirect. I don't know. I guess interferometry gets to being pretty direct, so I guess that would that's it. But it's somehow, to me, not as... You know, you don't know where it's living and stuff like that. A localized Majorana, I guess I should say. By interferometry, you mean something about how the edges propagate that's sensitive to whether there's a Majorana inside?
Yeah, in the bulk.
Yeah, I suppose that's not different in principle from tunneling through the Majorana. I mean, it would be nice to have both. I'll put it that way.
Well, then, in that case, they may have already seen it in the Will experiments.
Yeah, I'm not qualified to comment on whatever controversy there is regarding those experiments. I guess there are one or two experimentalists who are not absolutely convinced.
Well, I mean, it's not an absolutely convincing experiment yet, but...
Which experiment are you talking about, you know?
This is an experiment by Bob Willett that's probably seeing a Majorana in the five hats quantum Hall state. Anyway, but maybe it's getting a bit far afield. So then finally, there are... various other correlated electron proposals. The one last one I'd like to mention, and then I'm done, is based on a proposal by Mr. Tsursu and McDonald, that those of you working on graphene may know about, which is like bilayer condensation in the quantum Hall effect a little bit. If I have a graphene bilayer, so two sheets of graphene with a little insulator in between, then in principle I can apply a voltage between them and hope for some exciton condensed state. What I want to imagine is actually that in order to solve the problem of making this very narrow insulating region, I don't want to do that. I want to take a single slab of strong top or thin film of strong topological insulator. So this is an archive preprint, and most of the work was done by Babak Saraja and Marcel Franz. The idea is that just between the two surfaces of a single strong topological insulator, I can get an exciton condensate if I can arrange the following situation. I want the bias voltage to be such that the top surface and the bottom surface are equally displaced away from a Dirac point. So the hope for this would be these new materials, the so-called tuned strong topological insulators that I think will be talked about on Friday. So the importance of this is, first of all, I think it's easier to make experimentally than anything in bilayer graphene, but even more, it's a slightly different state. It's a so-called topological exciton condensate. And the main difference, just to wrap up the talk, is that something that Babak and Marcel worked on previously is that if you could make this state in graphene, and there are disputes about what the transition temperature is, some of those factors are better in the strong topological insulator case, some of them are worse. If you could make it, and if you put a vortex of the topological, of the exciton condensate, then there's a mode that in the graphene case would be at zero energy if you had a single valley. In the topological insulator, you actually do have a single valley. So aside from the experimental possibility that this is a bit easier to measure because you only need one material, it's not a Majorana zero mode. I would say that vortices pick up... so very quickly, an exciton condensate is formally very much like a superconductor. You open up a gap, except it's a gap in the particle hole channel rather than the particle-particle channel. That gap, there will be zero modes in the gap associated with vortices, and there's an offset charge of every vortex. So to explain what I mean by offset charge, it's a little bit like the half quantum offset in sigma xy. You can still only add or subtract charge in discrete units, but the situation with a vortex is a charge of plus or minus e over 2 relative to before. But I think that since I've already talked for an hour and 45 minutes, that's probably enough for most of you. So just to summarize, there was this old picture which led to these beautiful experiments. There's a picture that, for some aspects, might be a bit more general. And then, as far as what new experiments could be done, both 2 and 3 are some suggestions for how we could maybe get exciting physics. But I do feel that it's impressive how rapidly the experimentalists, in particular, Zaida-san, were able to find this state and find a new topological state of matter. Thanks.
I think that was a remarkable talk. I think I counted at least 16 papers that Joel told us something about. It was truly an overview, and there could easily be many, many questions. So let me open the floor.
Joel, for this extended condensate, did you estimate the condensation temperature?
Well, there's a huge controversy about the condensation temperature even for the graphene case. In the original paper, it was proposed about 300 Kelvin. There's a different estimate by Epitov, which is well below 1 Kelvin. I can say what's better about this than what's slightly worse. So if you go by velocity with it, then this is not quite as good. But there's one good thing, which is the reason why this estimates are so different, incidentally, is that in a weak coupling exciton condensate, just like a weak coupling superconductor, there's an exponential dependence of TK. So some small factor of 3 or 4 or something in the exponential can make a big difference. The one good thing about this, there's a factor of 4 improvement in the exponential in this state relative to the one in the graphene case. And that 4 is just the fact that this is 1/4 of graphene. So depending on your magnitude of the exponential and velocity factors and so on that are specific to what topological insulator you're doing, even with the Epitov estimate, this could be something like a Kelvin, which is at least possible. With the McDonald estimate, this is room temperature, and we don't want to try and differentiate between this. I would say as a general statement with superconductors, trying to predict TC is kind of a mug's game. Of course, there is a program this fall on higher TC superconductors, so maybe that's not the general opinion, but I think in weak coupling VCS at least, it's that exponential is impossible for it.
Does the dielectric constant come into this estimate? Imagine it's pretty large.
Yes. It does, but that, again, that's dependent on what particular STI you're setting. I don't know that it's universal.
Well, they're all very, quite small gap systems.
Point 3 dB
for the smaller semiconductor.
Okay, but I mean, I don't know. We could probably ask, do you happen to know the dielectric constant of the I2S secret is?
Not yet. Is it surprising?
4 smaller than 10.
Probably around that.
Around 4?
Yeah, we haven't measured that, but my guess would be around.
So then it's not a lot different than silicon carbon.
So what's the story about chromium oxide?
Well, the story is that's not a topological insulator, but it's a material that breaks P and T and has a non-zero value of theta.
Is that an insulator?
Yes. It's an anti-ferromagnet insulator. So, for example, the theta there is probably not coming from this orbital contribution that's the key in topological insulators. I think it's just that by applying electric field, the atoms move, and that changes the magnetic. It gives me a candidate for a magnet. But it isn't. It's the only material I know where people have taken the time to isolate theta from other magnetoelectric couplings. And it also shows that the value of pi is not unrealistic.
So the setup above the putting a droplet of superconductor on top of it is we need to create the vortex inside. And then we record the vortex position, and there's an addition to all the conventional there is one more state which is fermionic but of this Majorana nature.
That's right. So then you wouldn't be able to directly probe it, but what they would like to do is actually a line junction, so 2 superconductors on top, and then finding some evidence of what's in between.
They have a number of very detailed sort of proposals, et cetera. Increasingly hard to make, but don't involve actually looking at a vortex and do something. Joseph's and Jeff Jones.
It's a little bit of a change. Yeah. So this is the basic idea of why this particular study comes out. Their paper is mostly, like, this is the first page and a half of the paper, or maybe the rest is how you can actually see. But when you think seeing it is harder than just throwing down a superconductor, it's, you need to make two superconductors at least.
Just talking about comparison view, this is quantum Hall effect. So you are like sitting on one plateau of quantum Hall effect, talking about sigma xy fixed quantum Hall effect. We can jump from plateau to plateau and generate sigma xx peak and something. So this is missing here. Is there anything we can do to jump from one plateau to another?
Actually, I worked a bit on the 2D case. So let me tell you about the 2D case, because that already has an interesting difference. And then for the 3D case, I think Andreas and Leon would probably be the people to ask. So I don't want to try to comment on the 3D case, because they certainly know more about than I do. For the 2D case, there is a neat difference. So let me draw the phase diagram. So my horizontal axis is going to be something like the strength of Rochefort coupling, something that mixes up and down spin and changes it from the quantum Hall case. So this is 2D. Let's say here I go from ordinary insulator to topological insulator by ramping up this Gutzberg coupling. So then with this order, this will be in a sort of integer quantum Hall class, because here up and down are not mixing. It's really true decoupled copies of integer quantum Hall physics. So this is the sort of IQHE, you know, Chopper-Coddington or whatever, plateau transition. But what happens when I turn on the Rochefort, and this is seen by, you're probably the third group to see this, Anuda et al. And I can't read it all. One group is a Curie or something like that. And, the difference is basically that if I think about the three single electron universality classes, orthogonal is always extended. Sorry, always localized in 2D. Unitary has these isolated points. Symplectic can actually have a 2D metal. And the generic situation is that you. So what this is saying is that at least in the 3D case, I shouldn't have a sharp transition. I should actually see a metallic region that remains finite even as I go at zero temperature. So for example, in experiments on this, you see a finite plateau transition width, but that goes to zero as I go to zero temperature. And here that should not be true. And then 3D, I mean, if anyone wants to comment on
this. Is this just imagination, or one can tune this thing?
This can be measured. One can tune it by changing the size of the quantum well in different samples. So, and to some extent, Molin can, the 2D person has done this. But as far as having an actual, I don't know of any data where there's an actual field applied that would let you drive that transition. So that's the 2D case. For the 3D case, we might hear about that a little on Thursday, or?
Not really, but maybe I add some detail to this. The two metal-insulated transitions turn out actually to be in the same universality class, which is the ordinary spin-orbit universality class that has been around for decades. Yet they're actually different, and that's if you look at certain boundary problems. The boundaries of the sample, and there the wave functions at the transition behave actually differently.
This is case of some surface multifractality wave functions.
Okay. So it's.
Any questions or comments? Okay, that's my joke.